Okay, so today we take a look at the way out of addiction. And maybe the first thing you say to yourself is, well, I'm not an addict. Okay, hold the phone just a minute. This is a topic in our particular geographical area that is really big right now. But remain open, please. I think once we take a little bit of liberty with the definition of addiction, I think we might find that this particular message out of Hebrews chapter 12 is very pertinent to each and every one of us on some level. Again, I want to encourage you, there's a whole series of very short, seven minute videos on the subject of addiction. If you go to Life Points and search box addiction, you'll see them there. And we can begin to get our hands around this very important topic. If not for yourself, personally, but certainly for those maybe in your family, in your family history, in your neighborhood, in the workplace. It's best that we know how best to administer to other people. Like depression that we covered last week. You may not think about this, but someone who has cancer has a 25% greater likelihood of being depressed. Someone with PTSD has a 40% more likelihood of being depressed. We pray for people with Parkinson's, 50% greater likelihood of being depressed. People with eating disorders, 50 to 75% more likely to be depressed. So sometimes on face value, what people are going through, we have to heap onto that, this reality that sometimes this depression seeps in. And addiction is no different. So let's get schooled up on it so we can understand ourselves and one another. Now we come to Hebrews 12, 1 through 3. It reads like this, therefore. Now whenever you see the word therefore, you don't just keep going, you have to go back. We'll go back in a second. Therefore what? Like, because of what? What do you mean therefore? Therefore, since we are surrounded by such a great cloud of witnesses, let us throw off everything that hinders and the sin. Listen to this. The sin that so easily entangles. Interesting. And let us run with perseverance the race marked out for us, fixing our eyes on Jesus, the pioneer and perfecter of faith. For the joy set before him, he endured the cross, scorning its shame. I like those words, scorning its shame, and sat down at the right hand of the throne of God. Consider him who endured such opposition from sinners so that they will not grow weary and lose heart. Are you losing heart today? Let's see what the word has to say. Let's break it down. Surrounded by such a cloud of witnesses. Surrounded. That's a key word there. Surrounded. What does that mean? It means surrounded. It means, like the Israelites, who this letter is being written to, the Hebrews, they would have understood this to be the cloud by day and the fire by night, to be enveloped in, to be surrounded, to be hemmed in by goodness, to be hemmed in by God, to be in the presence of God. That's what this audience would have picked up on. Since we are surrounded by such a great cloud of witnesses, therefore, if you go back to the previous chapter, is the hall of faith, not fame, faith. And you have the list of all of these people had great faith. And they tell a little bit of their stories. So if you go back and read chapter 11, you'll see these are kind of the people that are surrounding us. These witnesses, these martyrs, these divine cheerleaders, these people who have set an example with their life of abandoning everything for the cause of Christ. Their testimonies ring out in their physical absence that you can press on, you can do it. Therefore, since we are surrounded by such a great cloud of witnesses, not that heaven is picking on you and watching you every day. That's not it. There's a testimony, there's a story, there's a victory story that it resides in each one of these people. And these things sort of speak to us, even through the scripture, even the previous chapter. There's a bunch of cheerleaders out there whose stories of our ancestors of faith before us that say, press on, press on, press on. I know you're in a bind. I know you're hurting. I know you're oppressed. I know you're down. I know you're enslaved. I know you're in exile. Whatever the case may be, they know they were there. And this great cloud of witnesses speaks to us in that way. I remember when I was just a kid in middle school, and when you get to middle school and you play basketball, something really cool happens. The cheerleaders, there's a cheerleading team assigned to you now. They come to the basketball games, and when you go to the foul line, somebody, it didn't matter who, somebody was elected to go out and say, Gary, he's our man. If he can't sink it, no one can. And I thought, these goofy cheer and everything, pointing their toes, and I always thought, wow, neat. I mean, I bet a lot of people could make a foul shot. If I couldn't do it, I'm sure there was a million other people could make one. But at the moment, that cheerleader made you feel like, well, the pressure, you better make it. But besides that, you can make it. That's who these cloud of witnesses are. This martyrs that cry. There's a martyrs beneath the throne room of God right now. These martyrs are saying, how much longer before you avenge our blood? The people that have given of everything for the cause of Christ, in the name of Christ, of which we sing. There's a lot of people out there that didn't just sing a song with a nice lyric of sacrifice. There's a lot of people out there who were martyred, being martyred, will be martyred. They cheer us on. He says, therefore, since we are surrounded by such a great cloud of witnesses, then he says, throw off everything that hinders. I get this picture of a backpack on a hike, and it's full of like sand or weights, you know, and it's just like weighing down on you. And what he's saying is, listen, these people have been where you are, and they're telling you to press on. Now listen, we've got to figure out how to throw that backpack off. Because if we can throw that backpack off, we can not only walk, we can not only hike, we not even scale a mountain, we can run. The question is, how do we get that weighty backpack off of us with the cheerleaders pushing us towards letting it go? Jesus deals with this in so many different ways. He says, all those who are weary and what? Heavy laden with emotional baggage. All those who are weary and heavy laden, come unto me and I will give you rest. Let's get that thing off your back. And when we get into what an addiction is in a few minutes, I'm telling you what God would want for you and those listening and those who will listen is let's figure out how we get that thing off of you. It is weighing you down. Even the psalmist in Psalm 42 verse 5 says, why are you so downcast, speaking to his own soul? Why down? Why beaten? Why weighed down? Why restricted? Why enslaved? Psalm 3, this is beautiful. Like if you ever get to where, you know, you need someone to do this to you, he's the lifter of our head. He's our shield and the lifter, the glory and the shield and the lifter of our head. Cast your cares on me, he says, and I will sustain you and never let the righteous fall. How do you roll this weight off of yourself? How do you take this genetic predisposition? How do you take this family history? How do you feel this weightiness just keeps you from being flexible and moving and agile and mobile? And how do you throw it off? With the help of these exemplary martyrs cheering us on. Well, it's somewhere in this transaction. When Jesus said he was crushed for our iniquities, that's pressed down, like crushed. I think of like a junkyard where you're crushing an automobile. The weight of sin just, whoom, right on him. Crushed for our iniquities, Isaiah 53 and 5. And the Lord had laid on him the iniquity of us all. This thing that you're carrying, this baggage, this weight, this backpack that's keeping you from hiking. We're going to look this morning on how you take that and accept the fact that he took that for you as your substitute. And I can tell you, if you're dealing with a full-fledged addiction, you're not meant to do it on your own. It's not the will of God that you do it on your own. We're in need of someone beyond ourselves. We'll get to that in a second. C.S. Lewis put it this way. This is an incredible quote. Fallen man is not simply an imperfect creature who needs improvement. I hope you didn't come here just to improve today. Fallen man is not simply an imperfect creature who needs improvement. He is a rebel who must lay down his arms. Man, I like that. You can go to Barnes & Noble today, and you can go to the self-help section, and you can find out all different kind of ways on you can improve your life. You go over to the biblical section, and about 60% of the books are going to help you figure out how you lay down your arms, how you surrender, how you find victory in letting go, throwing off, surrendering. The thing and the paradox about Christian faith And what makes it so powerful and so unlike any other world religion is that the victory is not found by fighting, 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 fighting. The victory is found by surrendering, surrendering, surrendering. Amen. Surrendering to the name, to the power, to the purpose, to the will, to the love, to the grace, to the mercy, to the abundance, to the lavishness of Christ. Surrender. Surrender what? Throw off everything that hinders. And then he says, the sin. The sin. This word is so misunderstood. It means to wander from the path. It doesn't mean to shoot at the wrong, to miss the bullseye. It means to shoot at the wrong target altogether. Sin is a transgression of God's law, a rebelliousness. The real problem that we have is sin, and Jesus has provided himself the real solution. The problem that the challenge that we have in the world in which we live today, especially among college students, is that the culture has taught us that there is no sin. Therefore, we have really no problem. And if we have no problem and it's all a relative thing, then everyone figures out their own solution on their own. Well, the problem with that is not everything is the solution. If you're in college today, those of you, and I talked to you last week, some of you about this, those in college, going to college, take comfort in the fact you're a sinner, okay? And everyone you go to school with is a sinner. And we all fall short of the glory of God. It's not the end of the world because there's a real solution to that problem. And this is good. It doesn't lie within you. You don't want a solution coming from within you that is the very person who got you in the situation. You want someone beyond you, and that's Christ. It doesn't make you less than. It makes you more than valuable because he paid for you with his life. This is what makes you worthy. Not shame, not less than, not low self-esteem, not confusion, not fear, not trepidation. No, you're worth it. He came to pursue you. This is huge. He says, throw off everything that hinders. He said, the sin, here we go, that it so easily entangles you. Now, think about your life. Do you have something, some behavior, something in your life that seems to somehow over the years, maybe even have picked up momentum, it kind of entangles you? I can't help but think of Spider-Man in this situation. So either Spider-Man 1 through 25, any one of those. When he shoots the spider web on you, you're like, I can't move. And then he wraps it around you, and then you're like, that's it. The word entangle in Greek means, guess what? Surround. He says, you're really surrounded by such a cloud of witnesses that are cheering you on. But we get into this thing where we get into this sin and we let it crouch in. We don't throw it off. And what happens now? We get surrounded by it. We can't move. It means to be skillfully surrounded, to be restricted, to be hindered, to be hobbled like a horse. If you're from the inner city, you know what a boot is. You put a boot on a car, that yellow metal thing on your car wheel and won't let you drive. That's easily entangled. All-encompassing, spider-like, enslavement. It is to be among accusers rather than cheerleaders. And the writer of Hebrews gives us this, surrounded by a cloud of witnesses and surrounded by this sin that so easily entangles us. It's gross. And herein lies, if left unchecked, where an occasional enslavement becomes an addiction. Now, I don't know, I've never met a person who got up and said on their calendar, today I start. Today, I'm working my way up to a case of beer a week and a fifth of Jack Daniels. I've never, ever heard anybody say, I'm starting Tuesday. What are you doing Tuesday? I'm going to start moving up towards a pack a day of cigarettes. If I can get up to a pack within a month, that'll be my goal. I've never heard anybody say that. But I've seen people do it. I've seen people smoke a pack of cigarettes a day and drink a fifth of Jack Daniel. Did they set out to do that? No. So easily entangled. Shh, 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 Spider-Man. That's the way it happens. I know of what I speak. Addiction. easily entangled area of life that can, and if not thrown off, will take over and or deeply affect your life. That sounds kind of drastic. What is addiction? Addiction means to be enslaved to be enslaved to be told by something what you will do, when you will do it, how you will do it, and how you'll feel about doing it. To be enslaved to something, here's the key, despite negative consequences. If you continue to do it, you're going to continue to do it despite the fact that it's killing you, despite the fact that you have health issues, despite the fact it's ruining your relationship, despite the fact you were living paycheck to paycheck, despite the fact you have this deep sense of dread and shame. Forget all of that. Enslaved to something means you're going to pursue it no matter what the consequences are, and they are negative. Legal issues, financial issues, marital issues. It's ugly. That's when you're easily entangled, you see. You can't move, you can't make choices. Choices are made for you. You're seemingly moved about in your own life. Now, there's two things you can be enslaved to. One is a substance. Alcohol, drugs, you know what those are, you know. All kind of illicit drugs. Controlled substances are called controlled substances because they end up controlling you. Substances... Methamphetamines, prescription drugs, sleeping pill. You know them all. That's pretty obvious. Substances, nicotine. And oftentimes when you withdraw that substance from you, you have issues, physiological issues, relational issues, psychological issues. You have issues, spiritual issues. All right, that's a substance. We all get that one. Now here's one. Careful, I'm coming after you. You can be addicted to a substance. But you can also be enslaved to a behavior. What do we mean? Well, you know, shopping. Hoarding. Gambling. Pornography. Behaviors that tell us what we are, when we are, who we are, that no one set out to be enslaved by. Behaviors. Cynicism, apathy, being critical of other people. Give me a little liberty on addiction here. I'm in a crowd of people that I realize that you're not probably, well, I know some of you are, but not most of the people here, the vast majority of people here are not addicted to alcohol, okay? I get that. But I do see patterns. I have counseled with people. I see this in my own life. I see behaviors repeating themselves over and over and over. And one, we expect different results. And two, despite the negative consequences, we continue with the behavior. Enslaved. Throw off that sin that so easily entangles us. Getting a little closer to home. When you interact with somebody, do they leave that interaction? And does your relationship with them cause them a greater amount of courage or a greater amount of discouragement? Have we set patterns of dealing with our children that are alienating them from us? And do we continue to do them and not break that pattern of behavior despite the fact it's hurting the relationship? Negative consequences. Family and familiar are very similar words for a reason. What is most familiar to us becomes family. And we begin to operate with an MO that becomes predictable. And the problem, you know, it's predictable, is when you actually change the behavior, the people you're with still hear you saying what you used to say because it's so predictable that you're going to say it, even though you didn't, and they interact with you as though you said it. Do you have any of your conversations go, I didn't even say that. Yeah, but you've been saying it for 15 years. I kind of was expecting it, so I responded to you as though you said it, enslaved, in a rut. So we become addicted to substances. We become addicted to behavior. Why? Because we are motivated as human beings that have fallen short of the glory of God, we are motivated out of emptiness. We don't like emptiness. We really don't. And emptiness will thrust us into any and every behavior, to any and every substance that helps us not to feel empty or not to be deemed as empty, to not be defined as empty, to at least periodically have the impression that I'm not empty, to at least momentarily or for 6 hours or for a night on the weekend to be defined as someone that has a purpose, that has courage. It is somebody other than I normally am in my everyday life. Emptiness. Emptiness is why we fill ourselves with substances and behavior. Emptiness is why we look for affection in the wrong places. Emptiness is why we're lustful people. Emptiness is why we're into pornography as a nation. Emptiness. This imbalance. And Jesus ran into this all the time. He ran into addicts time and time again every day of his life. The Pharisees were religious addicts. An insatiable emptiness to be filled with legalities and customs and heavy burdens to be thrown upon men. Look at the most empty people in your life, and I'll tell you who's around them. Equally empty people that don't make them stand out as an empty person. The addict will surround himself with addicts for fear that if he didn't, he'd stand out as being an addict. A religious glutton. A legalist will surround themselves with legalists, not people of grace, so as not to appear to stand out as a legalist. The Pharisees were addicts. The drunkards were addicts, and they didn't like it. They couldn't stand the scandalousness of Jesus having dinner with a drunkard, or an adulteress, or a prostitute. Addicts, 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 empty, 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 empty. Looking for some sort of identity, fulfillment, satisfaction. Even the high priest, a religious glutton, motivated by the, in today's dollars, $1 billion corrupt industry of the temple sacrifices and money changing. There's addicts everywhere. Now, we like to define them as people that are sitting on a sidewalk, over a grate, staying warm, drinking a bottle. That's comfortable for us to do that. But friend, Gary included, do we have behavior in our life that so easily entangles us and puts us in a pattern, in a rut, in a direction, despite the negative consequences we continue with it? Oblivious to what it's doing to those around us, we continue to drive that wagon right into every conversation. And never does it get thrown off of us. Never. We schlep that thing around like it's a diamond ring. Critical spirit, apathy, empty, never imparting life, empty. Reminds me when I was in high school and I'd borrow my dad's car and the light that said you needed gas was so bright you had to put sunglasses on and it stayed on constantly. I was so broke. That's an addict, empty tank. Fill me, fill me, fill me, fill me. Throw off the sin that so easily entangles us and then run with perseverance. Running is, apart from the Lord, I got to say, running, a runner's high is one of the coolest things that you can possibly experience in life. I spent a season of my life running it quite a bit. And there's something when you get a runner's high where the dopamine, the noradrenaline and everything's coming through you and you're running and you can run faster and faster and you look down and, hey, my legs are really moving. You can't even feel it. Of course, we can't run up here because you'd have to be a masochist to be a runner up here. That's a whole nother sermon. But there's running, the freedom of running, effortless breathing on autopilot. Your body's tuned in, moving, man. You're not, you're tireless. You could run forever. He says, I want you to run with perseverance. Run with liberty. I used to run in a marathon, in the Marine Corps marathon in Washington, D.C. They had a separate division for guys like me. It's called the Clydesdale Division. That meant that you were, well, you weren't going to be seen anywhere on the track with a Kenyan. You were of the larger sort, big boned men. And I had its own division, like, you're a Clydesdale. All right, thank you, I think. But I had my race. As a Clydesdale, I had my race. The Kenyans had their race. You have your race. Run freely. Run with liberty. Run the race marked out for you. One of the most important verses in the Bible that we don't understand, and it's very important we do. It's Philippians 4 and 19, or excuse me, 3 and 16. Philippians 3 and 16, listen to this. Live up to what you have attained. Live up to what you have attained. What we like to do is compare ourselves to what we perceive others have attained. And then we'll compare and contrast our worth, our value, our growth, our maturity, our purpose, and our mission in life. No. Live up to what you have attained. What have you been taught? How have you been challenged? What does your race look like? Are you a Clydesdale? Do you have a pace? Are you running your race at your pace or someone else's race at their pace? The addict is fulfilled with being a good steward of what they've been given, the opportunities, the information, the teaching, the prayer, the encouragement. There's a race marked out for you, and there's one for me. They may even be different distances, at different paces. All we're trying to do in this church is to take every single person and move them one concentric circle inward closer to Christ. When you try to be Billy Graham with such high expectations in your race, you end up disappointed. One circle closer. The 120 to the 70, the 70 to the 12, the 12 to the 3 to the 1 into the glory of a relationship, an intimate relationship with Christ. Run your race, unencumbered, unrestricted, unbridled. Living in the limitless possibilities of the stewardship that is imparted to you, that you are responsible for where you are in your life as a human being and as a believer. If you're not a believer, none of this is making sense to you right now, and it shouldn't. In fact, it should make you feel a little bit uncomfortable because your race hasn't started. Your race hasn't started, and that's okay too. It needs to start. But live up to what you've attained. And then he goes on to say, fix our eyes on Jesus. You heard it a million times. Stop. Let's call it 20-second timeout. Fix your eyes on Jesus. This is the temptation that exists in a church. Fix your eyes on politics. Fix your eyes on government. Fix your eyes on the community. Fix your eyes on one another. Fix your eyes on national politics. Okay, be aware, that's fine. But fix your eyes on Jesus. You can be in ministry and miss Christ. The insatiable thirst to long for him above all things. Churches go through ebbs and flows and patterns and ups and downs. Ministering to the sick and the disabled and the hungry and even the unborn in this church. We have all different kinds of ministry. But don't make your ministry the focal point. Don't make me the focal point. Don't make my family the focal point. Don't make your family the focal point. Don't make your job, your career. Workaholics, you're enslaved to your job, which is costing you immediately, so you're going to say time with your family. I would say even time fixing your eyes on Jesus, the author, the pioneer of your faith. I've met with people recently, and it's like this. Roll the tape. My life stinks. They told the story so many times, they can tell you how much pain they've been through, how long it's been happening. I'm going to accentuate this void in my life. I'm going to magnify it. I'm going to, by the 20-minute conversation, we've worshipped depravity. We've worshipped depression. We've worshipped emptiness. We've exalted it. Where is this name Jesus? Where is this fixation on him? As a pastor, you gotta get people to say, can we back to looking at Jesus? Can we get back to looking at him, Christ and him crucified? Because we get distracted by well-meaning, well-intentioned things. And I'm saying to you, your job's important. But he's more important. What happens is we get our eyes off of that and we've become empty. Empty. And we're not building one another up, we're tearing one another down. We're accentuating differences, differences of opinion, differences of style, differences of everything. Fix your eyes on Jesus, the author, the pioneer and perfecter of your faith, for the joy set before him endured. Endured. Suffered. Prolonged passion, endurance. Crossed the finish line, scorning its shame. I tell you, we put some videos on Life Points, and the video that gets watched more than anything else is this word shame. People identify with shame, less thanness. You know, I'm not worthy, and it permeates our culture. Shame. People want to know about shame. It's an emptiness that you can only fill. And then, what did he do? He sat down. I like the fact Jesus sat down. I'll tell you what you do at the end of a race. You sit down. Why? You completed it. It's a punctuation mark on the finality of the finished work of Jesus Christ. I'm done. Let me sit down. And not until Stephen is stoned does he stand up. He sat down. It's finished. It's finished. But yet we schlep this backpack of emotional baggage with us that looks like it's something purposeful to carry. And we want to rehearse it and talk about it. How horrible our life has been. The trauma that we've experienced. Okay, I get it. But can we fix our eyes on Jesus, the author? We're down at Western Carolina and having a wonderful opportunity to minister to athletic coaches and their families and their marriages and their athletic teams, and God's opening up some incredible doors. One of the first things I heard about down at Western is Thirsty Thursdays. Thirsty Thursdays. That's where everybody goes out and gets drunk. Thirsty Thursday is the greatest thing that happened to a college ministry since the scripture. Thirsty Thursdays draw people to a deeper level of thirst for Christ. They don't realize it. Thirsty Thursday. Great for ministry. Jesus in John 4:10 said, if you knew the gift of God, to the Samaritan woman, if you knew the gift of God, who is it that asked you for a drink? You would have asked him and he would have given you living water. John 7:38, let anyone who is thirsty, he says, let anyone who is thirsty come to me and drink. Psalm 42:1-3, as the deer pants for streams of water. Picture the deer as the deer pants, parched, throat cracking, panting in the desert of Judea. As the deer pants for streams of water, so my soul pants for you. It pants for you, my God, not God, my God, my personal God. I long for you. I pant for you. I gotta have you. Oh, there's a church that walks into a sanctuary on a Sunday morning, panting, panting. Drink or die. That kind of panting. Drink or die. Christ or death. God or enslaved. That desperation. This is amazing that this psalmist who was cut off from worship. He was alienated off into a land. He couldn't worship at the temple. He missed the presence of God, and he just longed for that so bad. Longing, passion, a dire desperation, a holy depletion. Now let's put it all together. The Waymaker series. There can be an upside to being hemmed in by the mountains, facing the Red Sea with 600 chariots chasing you. There can be an upside. There can be an upside to being depressed, to being down, to be acquainted with sorrow and grief. There is an upside. There can be. There can be an upside to being in a cave, rehearsing your problems. For at the mouth of the cave, the mouth of God speaks. Not in the earth, not in the wind, not in the fire. There is an upside to depression. There's an upside to being hemmed in. There's an upside to being addicted. Yeah, I said that. There is an upside to being addicted. There is an upside to being dissatisfied. If your addiction leads you to a place of powerlessness, if being hemmed in causes you to be desperate for an intervention that gives glory to God and no one else, it was a good thing. Spurgeon said it this way, the next best thing to living in the light of the Lord's love is to be unhappy till we have it and to pant hourly after it. A nation ruled by lust, a nation empty, a nation desperate, a nation afraid of terror, a nation in deep debt. All great things, if they reveal a dissatisfaction and an emptiness and an abandonment and a powerlessness and a humility that causes that nation and her church to cry out and pant and long to drink or die. And we ask God, why are you allowing this? I just gave you the answer. To bring us to a place of parchedness, desperation, to where we fix our eyes on Jesus, the author and perfecter. If you want to speak in addiction terms, you hit bottom. You hit bottom. When this country hits bottom, there's going to be an outpouring of the Holy Spirit unprecedented for the thirst and the longing and the desperation of its people. Addiction moves in stages. The first one is sort of recreational. Recreational use, recreational behavior eventually turns to sort of regular behavior. I regularly complain. I regularly am dissatisfied. I regularly I'm going to put you down. I regularly I'm going to do this. And I experimented with it, and it felt good, and I felt empowered, and now I'm going to do it on a regular basis. I'm going to try a few cigarettes. I'm going to drink a little bit. I'm going to do this. And eventually what happens in this regular routine is that it becomes risky. The regular becomes risky because people are starting to say something. Do you need the sixth glass of wine? See, the riskiness kind of gets in there. And what was recreational has become regular, and now it's risky. Now it's starting to, people are starting to say, what is going on here? And we immediately think, well, don't judge me. Don't do that. I'm not judging you. I'm pointing out there may be a possibility that there's an area of emptiness we're trying to fill. That's not judging. That's loving. Are we empty? And then after recreation and regular and after risky and after your behavior begins to hurt the relationship or it's a detriment or there's a time lost or whatever it is, financial, legal, whatever, then you enter into this stage of dependency. Dependency is, all right, you're telling me what I need to do, when I need to do it, I'm listening, tell me. I know it's going to hurt and I know it's going to cost me. I'm going anyway. How did we get there? And I'm saying to you today, it's okay. If somewhere in that process, you're like a deer in the desert. The very thing you're trying to avoid, the very thing we try to cover, the very thing we try to rationalize, and the very thing we try to deny is the very thing we need to embrace. The deer panting for the water brook. Oh, my soul longeth after you, my God, my God. How is it that we come to the place where we can take off that heavy sandbag that keeps us limping, let alone running? Parallel that heaviness with a desperation. And if we resist the desperation, a loving, pursuing, lavishing God, he'll get you there. He'll get you there. For he allows it. He allows anything to happen in our life whose result will bring him glory and bring us into his lap, where we pull on his beard and say, Abba, Father, Abba, Father. What are you rehearsing? What's your MO? What is it costing you? Why are we continuing to schlep that around? What conscious decision can we make today that behavior has me? I don't have it. Oh, we never mean for it to hurt. We never mean for it to divide. We never mean to graduate to that level. Think about that.